Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jane Whitfield, president of Whitfield Consulting, and your moderator for today's program. Today's program is being held in association with the United Way of the Bay Area, Northern California Grantmakers, the Association of Fundraising Professionals, the Marines Memorial Association, Tipping Point Community, the Veterans Health Research Institute, Swords to Plowshares, Google, PG&E, and the Grant Humanitarian Foundation. Our focus today is veterans of the military and how our community can best support them. Our conversation today is especially important to me as my stepson, Marine Sergeant Matthew Abate, lost his life in Afghanistan last December. Needless to say, I have a strong commitment to the cause of veterans and their families. Nearly 2 million veterans live in California, with more than 200,000 in the San Francisco Bay Area alone, and tens of thousands of troops returning home over the next year. Collaboration between philanthropy, corporations, and government is being hailed as the possible solution for urgent needs of this population. Joining Forces, a White House initiative announced in March, is an attempt to catalyze this collaboration by increasing the national discourse. Many major corporations have recently pledged millions of dollars to fund services for veterans as well, largely in response to joining forces. However, there's still a need to coordinate funding and services within communities and regions. Today, we will look at how to best proceed with a more organized effort, especially here in California and the Bay Area. And now I'm pleased to introduce our prominent panel. Paul Rykoff is Executive Director and Founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, also known as IAVA. IAVA is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group with over 100,000 members around the world. IAVA was founded in 2004 and is America's first and largest Iraq and Afghanistan veterans organization. Mr. Rykoff was a first lieutenant and infantry rifle platoon leader in the Iraq War from 2003 to 2004. He is now a nationally recognized authority on the war in Iraq and issues affecting troops, military families, and veterans. IAVA conducts a nationwide college tour, testifies at congressional hearings, crafts and supports critical legislation proposed by both Republicans and Democrats, and recently led the historic and successful fight for a new GI Bill. Welcome.
Thank you.
Major General Mike Myatt has served as president and CEO of the Marines Memorial Association since 2001 and as chair of San Francisco Fleet Week Association. General Myatt served 2 combat tours in Vietnam. He also commanded the 1st Marine Division during Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm in 1990 and 91. General Myatt was commissioned a Marine Corps second lieutenant after graduating with a bachelor's degree in physics from Sam Houston State University in Texas. He also holds a master's degree in engineering electronics from the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome. Deborah Alvarez Rodriguez has served as president and CEO of Goodwill Industries in the Bay Area since 2004. Known for her dynamic leadership style, she has over 15 years of executive experience spanning nonprofit, philanthropic, public, and private sectors. Prior to joining Goodwill, Ms. Alvarez Rodriguez was vice president of Silicon Valley's Omidyar Foundation, the family foundation created by the founder of eBay, where she developed community building, human services, and grant making strategies. She also worked in San Francisco city government, notably as executive director of intergovernmental and school link services at the San Francisco Unified School District and assistant director for budget and planning for the San Francisco Department of Health. Ms. Alvarez Rodriguez is a graduate of Harvard Radcliffe College. Welcome. And our final panelist is Anna Thompson, executive director of Charles and Helen Schwab Foundation. The foundation supports entrepreneurial organizations working to transform the educational and economic opportunities for those living in poverty. In 2009, the foundation extended this work to post-9/11 veterans. Ms. Thompson has more than 25 years' experience in management and consulting in both the for-profit and nonprofit sectors. Prior to joining the foundation in 2001, she served as Chief Financial and Administrative Officer for Lutheran Social Services of Northern California. She also worked at Deloitte Consulting and First Manhattan Consulting Group, advising financial services clients, and she currently serves on the board of the Philanthropy Roundtable. Ms. Thompson holds a BA in Slavic Studies from Harvard and an MBA from Stanford Business School. Please welcome all of our panelists. Well, I am especially delighted to be here today and humbled to be here with such an important group of people, and I'm personally grateful to each of them for accepting our invitation to be on this panel today. And with that, I'd like to ask a question that I'd like you each to respond to, and I think I'll start here with you, Paul, and ask you to go down. Our purpose today is to think about communities and how communities, especially our community, can best serve veterans. So, Paul, from your perspective, how can a community come together to support our veterans?
Well, first off, thank you, Jane, for having me here. It's a real pleasure and honor to be at the Commonwealth Club, and I really appreciate how we started exactly at 12 o'clock. As a military person, I appreciate that, and I like the gavel, too. We may have to take that back to our office. But I think, you know, everything that we've seen in our work nationwide, it's patchwork right now. You know, it's a really scattered landscape. There are folks doing great work, and then there are huge holes in different regional areas. But the most effective consistently is when a community really wraps around a veteran, when they take a vested interest in that veteran, in their success, in their family, and really integrate them as a part of the community before, during, and after. And that includes the families. We say in our organization a lot that, you know, you deploy the service member, but the family member goes along for the ride. And they don't get the awards, they don't get VA benefits, they are often left to try to pick up that end of it, as you and others well know. So I think the real opportunity lies within communities. Folks stepping up and finding out what's worked in the past for other at-risk communities, but also innovating. I think at the local level is where we can see the most effective programs that can be taken to scale. Because whether it's PTSD or military sexual trauma or employment, there aren't too many really widespread, strong national programs that are really innovative. There are older programs that have adjusted, and a lot of programs that have worked for other generations of veterans, but the average IAVA member is 28 years old. 15% are women. Only about 50% are enrolled at the VA. They don't open paper mail. They're on Facebook and Twitter. So the way they interact, the way they communicate, the way they network, the way they get support is totally different. So I think at its core, you know, long-winded answer to your question is that the true success and breakthroughs, I think, that can really make transformative change and lasting impact are going to be at the communities. And the most exciting part of that, I think, is the veterans themselves. They are now starting their own nonprofits. They're working at NGOs. They're getting involved in local governments. And what we say all the time is that the young men and women coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan are not charity. They're an investment. So the more we can do at the local level to empower them, I think will ultimately lead us forward in a huge way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that I'm part of this panel. And I just want to make it relevant to the audience here that 1 in 9 in the military today are Californians. A lot of people don't realize that. Half those are from Northern California. And even though we don't have a lot of military bases anymore around San Francisco, we still have a lot of veterans in Northern California in the San Francisco Bay Area, many who are on had made multiple tours to Iraq and Afghanistan. I will tell you, there was a study that came out in September 2007. It was done for the Veterans Administration. It was a study done on veterans employment. And it was an independent study, and they came up with the term recently separated service members, and I'll call them Iraq, Afghanistan war veterans. And they said that their study said that their unemployment rate in September 2007 was 3 times higher than their cohort population. And the reasons for that, they went into many reasons, but they gave 3 solutions. They said, first, we need to rebrand the veteran. Even the term veteran in many cases has a negative connotation. Second thing they said is that we need to help them network because they're young and they haven't ever experienced the process of looking for a job. And so the third thing that we really need to do is we need to give them some skills. We need to give them some training. Now, that was given to the VA in September 2007, and I don't think anything was ever done with the report. But I look at the unemployment today, where we're no longer at a 6% as we were in September 2007, but it's much higher. And among the veteran population, in case of the infantry and the artillery, the combat arms, it can be the back-of-the-envelope calculation from Headquarters Marine Corps, it's up to 60%. Six out of ten that come back after serving their country can't get a job. So what I think the community can do is help us really rebrand that veteran. Because I want to tell you just for a minute what the kinds of youngsters that we're taking in the military today. 25% of the 17 to 27-year-olds even qualified to go in the military. Three out of four can't get in. You have to be drug-free. You have to be physically fit. You have to be morally fit. You have to have a high school diploma. But the biggest thing is you have to score high enough on what I call the entrance exam to even enlist in the military. And the number one reason that they actually enlist, these are surveys done by military.com that has, you know, a lot of members. The number one reason that they enlist is to have the opportunity to get careers, to get an education, to go get a good job. And yet they find themselves penalized when they come back because they've been off and they don't have any network, they don't have any connections. Somebody tells them how to do a resume, but they don't know who to give the resume to. So I think the community, we need to really understand what a great quality military we have today, rebrand them and tell people, you know, if you really know how good these youngsters are today, if you really know how good they are, you would say, I want to get somebody like that in my organization, or as many as I possibly can. So that's my point in terms of the community. Help us rebrand and understand how really good these youngsters are today.
Thank you very much. I want to thank everyone that's here today because this is such an important and salient conversation that we need to have. It's absolutely critical to the essence of the health and well-being of our communities across this country. So I'm really delighted to be here. You know, I come at this from an interesting, slightly different angle. I wear a couple of multiple hats. During my day job, I run Goodwill Industries for the Bay Area, which is one of the largest employment training and support programs in the Bay Area. And so I see it directly as a service provider that's working with almost 10,000 people a year trying to access and retrain and redeploy themselves in the labor market. But I also run a social enterprise, and we have about 800 employees. So as an employer, when I wear my employer hat, you know, I see it also from a slightly different perspective as an employer. And right now, my recruitment team is at Swords to Plowshares, their recruitment effort, because we're looking to hire. We hired two veterans just this last month, and we're basically hiring two to three every single month into our employment. So what are we looking for as an employer? And then when I wear my community foundation hat, because I sit on the board of a community foundation as well as a family foundation, what does it take to actually deploy the resources across a community that normally doesn't necessarily talk to each other? And so I'm excited to be here because I'm having my first conversation, and it should have been my third or fourth or fifth conversation. So a couple of things concretely, which is from those different vantage points. I think building off of what both Paul and the general said here is that we need to become informed, and we need to help the community become informed and debunk a huge amount of the myths that are swirling around these young returning veterans. When I'm in employer circles with other employers out there, the kinds of language and perceptions that I hear in those meetings, oh, they don't have the skills. What they learned in the military has no market-ready relevance. This is the term I hear all the time. It has no market-ready relevance, which is absolutely not true. Their social and other kinds of support networks have been fragmented by all these deployments and movements, and therefore they're not going to be stable. I need a stable employee. So we need to debunk those myths. I also think we need to help the community mobilize, and mobilize not just the veterans community, not just the the social service communities, but how do we actually mobilize and leverage all of the resources that are available? One of the things we do is we partner in Menlo Park, we partner with an entity called the Next Step Center, which is actually in the VA center, to deploy our coaches and our advisors and counselors and everything there. So how do we actually start bringing these siloed communities and siloed resources into cooperation with each other? The other one is just that we actually have to think about and have active conversation about how do we make this a priority. There is a level of fatigue, what I call civic fatigue and concern. The Harwood Institute, which really is an institute out of D.C. that looks at civic engagement, I happen to be on the board of that, it just finished its Main Street study. And what we discovered along the main streets of all sorts of communities across America is that the level of fatigue around my own concern and anxiety and distrust of institutions, of government, of business, okay, is making it difficult to actually have and reengage in an authentic conversation. And so how do we start literally saying, you know what, every single person in this audience, every single person that's listening to this program can be a philanthropist and donate money and resources to this issue. Every single person in this audience and in this community can be a service provider. We can be mentors. We can be coaches. We can be peer supports. There's a whole variety of things. We can get engaged and start reestablishing that trust. And then the last thing is, nothing happens if we're not creating jobs and hiring these young men and women. So we must make a commitment, and this is my hat as a social enterprise leader, is how do we actually create meaningful job opportunities? And those are rather broad. They're not just the high-paying, high-tech jobs. Meaningful job opportunities that we've discovered at Goodwill cover a full range from logistics and, you know, I love the logistics training that comes through the military. And anyone who runs a large logistics operation or business should hire someone from the military. So those are my suggestions.
That's great. Well, again, I'm very grateful to be here, and thank you for having me, and I'm also very humbled by my fellow panelists. I guess I would build on those comments, certainly, and maybe focus on three things: individuals, technology, and business. And in terms of individuals, I think one of the things we don't do is in our own individual lives reach out on a specific issue. So, you know, I would say if you don't know a veteran, try to find someone who served in your workplace or in your community or perhaps their spouse or family member and just acquaint yourself with them. It doesn't mean you need to ask them inappropriate questions, but in your own life, try to find out if you haven't already, and I imagine a lot of people in this audience have, but try to understand it in a sort of small, individual way. Another way you can really understand is if you go on Paul's website, it's IAVA.org. They have really powerful testimonials of fellows and women who have served and what they've been through, and you can look at those videos and also get an idea of what it's about. So I would think that's a very important step that the community can take. In terms of technology, as Paul mentioned, there's so much that technology can do to help us connect to veterans, to help veterans connect to each other, businesses to connect to veterans, and I think we should look for those solutions in this day and age. It's really important. For example, there's an organization called USA Together. I believe the founder's here, and it's sort of like a Craigslist for veterans. They vet, no pun intended, the veterans who have specific needs, one-time needs for services or money or other help, and you as a community can just go on this site and make a donation, or come, if you're a lawyer, you could help them with legal services, and it's an incredible way to leverage technology and bring community to the veterans. And the third, to build on the employment issue, I think businesses have a long way to go to debunk some of the stereotypes they have or the ignorance, and there are some efforts, particularly in Seattle, where they're trying to bring the head of hiring and talent management of these large corporations to military bases so they can see what the day in the life is, not of war, obviously, but of what kind of skills these military personnel have. And I think those kind of efforts can really go a long way to rebrand the veteran, as General Myatt said, and also help businesses see that it's in their enlightened self-interest to hire a veteran. It's not just a good thing to do. It's in their enlightened self-interest.
So that's kind of a daunting list in a sense, right? So we have to make sure we think of the family, provide more education and employment, provide job opportunities, be innovative, rebrand, debunk myths, get out there and meet veterans and all at the same time fight our own and our comrades, our colleagues' civil fatigue. So that's a pretty big order. And I can say over the last few months I've been from the White House to the Pentagon to the offices of many of these people doing work with veterans. And it's a big list. It's a big list. So if we had to just focus in right here in our own community and focus in on some of these focus in on this list, one that's come up, I think, from each of you is the idea of debunking myths and this idea of stigma. So I'd like to hear a little more about that. And particularly, I think we need to acknowledge that some of that is real, right? So for some of the population of veterans, there are real issues that they face. And I'd like to hear a little bit about those challenges and, you know, what local communities, what nonprofits, what health care providers, what us as individuals, what we might be able to do. And then still back to that fighting the stigma, how do we make the case that it's not 100% of veterans that suffer with some challenges. It's a small percentage. Anybody? Mike?
Well, one of the stigmas that our veterans are dealing with today is the issue, we call it combat stress. I don't really like the term post-traumatic stress disorder, and we're learning that the young Marines and soldiers don't like that D word anyway. They say, I don't have a disorder. But they've gone through some experiences that have changed them. I've gone through experiences that have changed me, and I've been diagnosed as somebody that has combat stress. And I don't think you can go through what they've gone through without having that experience. I will tell you, this last June, we had a marvelous conference that we actually hosted it, put on by the Veterans Health Research Institute, or NSEER, the Brain at War Conference. And one of the issues we talked about was this issue of combat stress. And there was a SEAL, this marvelous, he was a chief petty officer in the SEALs, and he was actually was discharged medically because he'd lost a leg in his last mission. But he was talking, the audience asked him, how do you feel? Do you feel disadvantaged that people know that you have combat stress? And he said, well, let me just tell you, he said, I admit I have combat stress. He said, don't worry about me. The kind of people you should be worrying about are those people that would go through what I went through and don't have combat stress. And combat stress is an issue that can be treated. It can be reduced dramatically. And I told these folks earlier, we were talking about when you go through the transition assistance program for each of the military, it's required by law, and it's divided between the Department of Labor, the Department of Defense, and the VA. So nobody's held accountable. And it's a kind of a disastrous program. And they go through, and there's a lot of money now in the process. If you have any kind of medical issues, you get in this line. There's really no money in the line for education or the line for employment and career development. What we need to do is put the money in those other things. But the stigma is aggravated when they come home and they can't get into a college, or they can't find a job, and they're sitting around talking with their old buddies that couldn't even go in the military, and that's when the drinking, the nightmares, and all that thing starts. So back to my point, I've wandered all around here. But the whole issue of combat stress, recognize people are going to have it. It can be mitigated, and they're not walking time bombs in your office. They are people who have proven themselves and deserve an opportunity.
Yeah, I'll just jump in. I think the best way is to just share the story. Tracy, who served in Desert Storm, and she showed up at Goodwill and looking for a job and some employment training programs. And it was an interesting thing. Tracy was fortunate because Tracy actually showed up and shared with us that she was a veteran. The number of folks that show up to our offices that are so fearful of sharing that information and actually start creating fictitious resumes to cover up their service records, which is, just crazy making for us, you know. But Tracy did. Now, Tracy had a lot of she had a lot of what I call logistics of life needs, right? She had some medical issues. She had some physical medical issues. She had some mental health issues. She had family issues that she was trying to put together, as well as she shared with us how difficult it was to navigate the VA and other kinds of systems there. I mean, it was a full-time job, and yet she really needed work. She was desperate for work. And here was an example where, as an employer, we had to be realistic. We enrolled her in a number of our job readiness training programs and other kinds of things. But she actually needed to earn a living. And so we put her in a job which gave her the flexibility to be able to move and do and take care of those other things. And so we have to actually set some expectations based on where the individual is. You know, her expectation would have been a more senior position, but the reality was she was having to leave work so often to take care of all these things that she needed a job that allowed us that. So she started as a donation attendant. Simple. It gave her the flexibility. It gave her the stability and so forth to attend classes and navigate all of this. She eventually went from a donations attendant to a logistics specialist at Goodwill, and she actually then she got attached to our employment recruitment networks. She now works at Swords to Plowshare, and she is doing recruitment and HR, which was actually her sweet spot and her desire. But the path was not a linear path, and I think that's one of the things we have to acknowledge is that many of the young women that we're seeing do have multiple issues. In terms of, you know, reintegration, as well as trying to get their lives somewhat in order. And they do have some reskilling so that their skills are applied to the marketplace, not just to the environment. And we need to have flexibility around them. And Tracy's a wonderful example of that.
And I think many of them also don't have all those challenges, which I think is kind of what gets lost from time to time. Yes, folks are coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder. Yes, folks are wounded. But not everyone is. You know, I think that's important to note, because what we face more than anything else is an unprecedented disconnect. Less than 0.5% of the American population has served in Iraq, so most people in the average room don't know anyone personally. In World War II, it was close to 12%. So you knew your dad or your neighbor or the guy at your job, and you had that personal, visceral connection to a real human being, not just someone on a news feed. So we've got to break down all of the stereotypes that exist just because folks don't know us. When it comes to the vets coming home, you know, I hire dozens of them, and no candidate that comes through has no challenges. I mean, everybody comes through your door is going to have some kind of challenges, but I'll take a vet every time, because not only have they been through this type of arduous process in the last couple of years, they're resilient. They know how to adapt and improvise and overcome. They know how to make do with small budgets. They are excellent with technology. They are obviously good team leaders and are going to have good haircuts and shine shoes. But they are very different, and they are focused, and they are entrepreneurial in a way that I don't see from the average 25-year-old walking into our office to interview for a job or when I'm traveling around the country. That's the piece that I think has really been underestimated. I had a 21-year-old squad leader who was managing millions of dollars worth of equipment, trying to do foreign policy in a language he didn't understand, trying to get a water system up and running, trying to pay teachers, and deal with a variety of HR issues that most people couldn't even begin to comprehend a couple thousand miles away from home in 120-degree heat. He can handle a sales desk, okay? And I think it's really understanding what these folks have been up against, and at the same time celebrating the folks who do well. If you ask someone, what do you think when you hear veteran? They'll tell you the cookie cutter answer, but if you close the door and ask them, they're going to have this stereotypical image of, you know, Ron Kovic from Born on the 4th of July. And we've got to break that down and understand that there are folks like Fred Smith who founded and lead FedEx. There are folks like General Myatt. There are leaders in industry from all generations, and from the World War II generation on through, that we don't really celebrate. A lot of Vietnam veterans don't talk about their veteran status, but they're CEOs and politicians and educators, and we need to elevate those stories a bit more. And when it comes to the veterans themselves, you know, one huge challenge. General Myatt touched on it. We launched one of the largest non-governmental outreach campaigns around mental health in history with the Ad Council. And part of it is just letting vets know that it's not abnormal to face combat stress. It's not abnormal to come home with these types of injuries. And if you got shot in the arm, you'd go in and get it taken care of. You'd get patched up and you'd get back in the battlefield. If you have a mental health injury, you have to approach it the same way. And that stigma does need to be kind of attacked head on. Not just, you know, mental health stigma is not unique to the military. There's a lot of mental health parity issues nationwide, and if we can help break that down, then I think that'll be a huge outcome for this generation.
If I could say rebranding, if we could describe that 21-year-old sergeant just like you did, Paul, that's the kind of rebranding. These are such high-quality folks. I hope that's recorded and we can play that again and again.
And I can find you a couple of those folks, too, so you can see me afterward.
Great comments. I think one of the advantages of focusing on community and businesses is that they can share practices and talk to each other. And so as a foundation, we look for organizations that are helping really build the capacity of employers to understand the value of a veteran and also communicate. And so, for example, there's an organization called Project Hired in San Jose, and they have a unique role because not only do they reach out to wounded veterans to help them find a job, but they also advise companies like Oracle, Juniper, Yahoo, Cisco on how to work with veterans that are wounded, even physically wounded, but also perhaps with some of the expected stresses, and how to work with them once they get the job, if issues come up, instead of just terminating an employee, trying to understand those issues. And then as more companies do that in a community, then others will sort of see and wonder what's up. So there's the competitive spirit plus just sharing best practices. So again, I think more organizations that are helping build that knowledge in a real way on the ground will help with this rebranding and actually result in jobs and retention. So.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing military veterans and how our community can best support them. Our panelists are Paul Rykoff, Executive Director and Founder of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, Major General Mike Myatt, President and CEO of the Marines Memorial Association, Deborah Alvarez Rodriguez, President and CEO of Goodwill Industries in the Bay Area, and Anna Thompson, Executive Director of Charles and Helen Schwab Foundation. I'm Jane Whitfield, the moderator. So I received a question from the audience that I want to ask because I think it speaks to the question of challenges. And here it is, just as it's written. Veterans volunteered. Why should we pay more taxes to help their post-service freedom? Debbie?
Well, I mean, I think none of us live in a vacuum. We are we believe in the values of the American Constitution, which is around we believe in a just and civil society. And so, you know, yes, they volunteered, and we must honor that service. Right? That service is helping us stay safe. It's helping us stay strong. It's helping us stay relevant in the world. And so I think it's a fair question to ask, but I also think in terms of as any one of us that, you know, some of the people I treat really well are my volunteers. I treat my volunteers well, right? Because they're doing this not because they have to. They're doing this because they have a larger purpose in life.
And if I could chime in, I mean, let's be honest, your taxes haven't gone up. I mean, there really hasn't been a huge demand on the average American to take care of my members coming home. You know, there is obviously tremendous funding for the Department of Defense, but that's different for the most part. And when it comes to VA funding, that in and of itself has been a battle. But let me break it down in other terms. A lot of times folks get confused between the war and the warriors. When I joined up in 1998, I didn't sign up for Iraq. I didn't know where I was going. And most of the folks who signed up post 9/11 didn't know where they were going either. They signed up to serve. And they don't just serve overseas. They're serving on our floods. They're serving in our earthquakes. I also served at Ground Zero on 9/11. So if you really don't want to take care of them, I think we've got to look ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves what kind of country we are. Because there's another issue here that we are also kind of we're the canary in the coal mine. If we are the folks that get celebrated and put in commercials and everybody claps for coming home and they get off the airport and we come home to an armed membership, which is a 20% unemployment rate, what does that mean for everybody else? What does that mean for the homeless people here in the Bay Area? What does that mean for the young kid coming out of school trying to get a job? You know, I think it's a real gauge of our country's core about how we take care of our veterans.
I guess I'll take that on a couple different angles. It's a good question. I'm not a fan of big government. I'm not a libertarian either. I think that for the soldiers who are wounded in action, whether they volunteered or not, as the employer, the government, as their employer, has an obligation to help them, particularly with medical benefits. I think, I mean, you can reform that system, but I do see an obligation there, and so that costs money. I also think, to put a little different twist on it, it's in the Department of Defense's self-interest to create a better pathway out of the military, and that might look counterintuitive because you might say, well, we want to keep them in to serve, to, you know, defend our country, but the military might actually recruit more people if it's viewed as a stepping stone to employment, and that could actually lower costs, I guess. And so I think there's an enlightened self-interest there, and the military is there to defend the country too, and so we do have an obligation to support it.
Well, let me follow up what Paul said. The military isn't just fighting wars. They're actually doing a lot of other things that are vital to our national interests. And there's a sign as you come out of Camp Pendleton, or there used to be, the Marines are at war, America's at the mall. It allows you to stay at the mall, I guess. But they're doing so many good things around the world, and it's going to be emphasized this week during Fleet Week that the best humanitarian assistance provider in the world is the United States military. I mean, look at what they did in Indonesia after the huge tsunami, I think in January 2006, totally changed the attitude of the Indonesians toward the United States. Look at what they did in Pakistan to relieving the floods. Look what they did in Haiti last year in terms of saving so many lives. There were at one time 17 or 18 ships and about 22,000 Army soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in there providing humanitarian assistance. Just this year in Japan, the nuclear issue clouded the real contribution that the military made to save thousands of lives in Japan. We're going to demonstrate some of that during Fleet Week this year because we know that one of these days there's going to be a catastrophic earthquake here in San Francisco, and we're going to need help. And why not? We have a saying in the Marine Corps, never introduce yourselves on the battlefield. Get to know each other before you have to fight together. Well, what we're trying to do is get people to know each other and work on the skills. It's been enormously successful already because of the planning and a tabletop exercise that we conducted in September. And when you see the quality of these military and all the things they bring to the table, I encourage you all to get down Saturday and Sunday to see what's called the Humanitarian Assistance Village. What these youngsters bring in capability that one of these days whoever asked that question is going to need, I bet you won't ask that question again. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I can add something to that. I don't know if I'm allowed to do that as the moderator, but I will.
Definitely.
You know, it was very interesting for my family when our son decided to join the Marines, being a liberal democratic family in the Berkeley Piedmont area. It wasn't something that most of our friends and colleagues and neighbors responded well to. And it was a really interesting situation we found ourselves in. And here's what I found myself answering. Everything that we had in our home in Piedmont and our employment and our businesses and our colleagues and our friends and our family is due to the fact that we have people out there fighting for our rights and fighting for our way of life. And even though personally I may not agree with some of the decisions that have been made in terms of what wars have been fought or the rationale for those, I don't actually know all the information that others who make those decisions know. And for me, I'm grateful that anyone would volunteer to do something that I know I would never do. And for that, I think we owe these people a debt of gratitude and a debt of service, and I believe that strongly. But similarly, I think whether you're talking about a veteran or a homeless person or a woman who's experienced domestic violence or any person in need in our community, we all have a civil responsibility to support those in need around us, and particularly in our own community. Maybe that'll be the only time I give my own point of view. Maybe not. lots of questions coming in from the audience, so I'm going to try and get through a few of them because I see that there's a lot of engagement and people. What do you think is the biggest obstacle facing the successful support of veterans in our country today? We've come up with a few ideas, but if there's one thing, and I've been to throughout, is it politics? Is it funding? Is it branding? Is it services? Is it coordination? What is it from your perspective? Anna?
Well, I'll go back to the employment focus. If you have you were in Iraq or Afghanistan and you were responsible for driving the equivalent of the ambulance and rescuing people and driving, and you do that in combat and you have a lot of responsibility, and then you come back and, oh, you can't get a whatever certificate you need to be an ambulance driver here, that's pretty ridiculous. You have training that when you go to college you can't get that translated into the credits. You learn to drive an 18-wheeler in wherever and come back and you can't do it driving down Highway 80. So that's sort of a policy change, but those kind of changes could really help pave the way to help folks transition. And in fact, I believe it's not possible for transitioning military, let's say they know they're leaving in 12 months, to go do an internship at a company. And if a company wanted to have them do an internship, it's a great way to get to know someone, but I think it's against the law. Seems sort of crazy. So some of those kind of things could be changed. That would help a lot.
Could I follow on to that? I think Ann is right that there's a real barrier, but there's something that's going on that I think is really exciting. It is today. It doesn't say you can, and it doesn't say you can't, because the way the lawyers interpret it today, it has to say you can before you're authorized to do something. So spending appropriated money to train an active duty service member in a skill that would be useful, that's not their particular primary military occupational skill, but would be useful on the outside, the lawyers say no. And we're doing something like that down at Camp Pendleton. We have a welding course going on. We're in our eighth course now. The union, the United Alliance, UA, is actually, they train Marines to be welders, and every one of them gets a job. Well, the lawyers have said that we have to stop doing that because it doesn't say in the law that you can do that. But what's exciting about it is that there's a bill that the House has passed and the Senate has passed, that when they finally do the Defense Appropriations Act, it will authorize appropriated funds to do exactly what she said, apprentice work. Now, why is that important to us? Well, in the fiscal year that ended September 2010, the Army spent about $650 million in unemployment. The Marine Corps spent $167 million in employment. In the fiscal year that just ended, 30 September, the Army spent about $880 million in unemployment, and the Marine Corps spent more than $200 million. That's starting to add up. So why not take that same money that's being used for unemployment and give people skills so that they can be hired and be paid up by participating taxpayers the day they're released from active duty?
Can I just I totally agree with everything the General said and Anna said in terms of the policy changes that need to be made. But we also need to be creating jobs in the United States. We have seen the largest growth of jobs being created by U.S. companies overseas in this last 5 years, and not here in the United States. So you can train people all you want, but if the jobs are not there, and if we're not creating the jobs, then there, what are the options for people? So we need to engage employers. And you've done some wonderful work in terms of the Schwab Foundation and supporting the employer side. We need to engage employers, not just around the job fairs. Those are wonderful, but actually the creation of more jobs and in this dialogue. Otherwise, we're going to be back to square one. I mean, we've got unprecedented unemployment. We have communities fighting for the same little crumb or for that one job. We post a job at Goodwill. This is Goodwill. We post a job at Goodwill, and we get 100 to 200 applicants for that job. So we have got to bring that into the equation.
Can I jump on that? We're actually hosting a job fair on Thursday here in San Francisco for about 200 of our local members, Iraq and Afghanistan vets, who are going to come to meet with employers. And we've got folks like Bechtel, Southwest Airlines. Last night we just added Tesla, an incredibly innovative, you know, local car company. We're also going to have folks like the Salvation Army and the Farmer Veterans Coalition and Swords to Plowshares. We're going to try to connect veterans with jobs. It's a model that we've been working on, and we're going to continue to innovate and improve as we go into other cities around the country. But one thing folks can do, if you want to support the troops, hire them. And it's a pretty basic thing, but to your larger question, I think it's important that we address the elephant in the room in my world, money. There's a real shortage of money in this space. There is no market for that innovative local nonprofit, and if there is one, it's pretty small. So, you know, the fact that Swords to Plowshares has to raise money at all, to me, is just bonkers. They do life-saving critical work here in the Bay Area. They need money. There are groups like TAPS in Washington, D.C. that do tragedy assistance to the children of people killed in action. They're only like a $7 million nonprofit, and their ED is probably spending 50% of her time raising money. The comparison I've used in the past is it seems a bit like AIDS 30 years ago, in that there's no path of philanthropic giving, there's no research in the space, there's no national awareness, there's no understanding of the urgency, there's no metrics for impact, and it's getting worse fast. So, I mean, every time I get in front of an audience, I've got to tell you that, you know, I don't see supply keeping up with demand. And at some point, we've got to have folks step up and stop middling around the edges and create a legitimate marketplace for these most impactful nonprofits. We don't have our Haiti fund. You know, the two presidents didn't stand up and raise $500 million for veterans. And until that happens, there's going to be a lot of middling around the edges and a lot of great nonprofits that are scraping to get by.
Well, that actually leads to a question I have, which is, should taking care of our veterans receive special status in the world of philanthropy? And why? Anna?
Well, I'll give you the unexpected answer, which is no. And the reason I say that, and then the next turn I would try to convince you to give as much as possible, the reason I say no is that one of the most excellent part of philanthropy is that it's based on the individual passions and values of the founders of the various foundations or individual donors. And that passion is what leads to creativity and solutions to a wide range of issues, whether it's saving the environment, espousing free market ideals, to veterans or mental health. And so I don't think there should be a global should on the philanthropic community. What's great about it is its independence and its ability to come at things from many different angles. So it has to go back to the values of the founder. So, but for our foundation, it's a very important priority, and both because of the importance of honoring the sacrifice that veterans have made, as well as it's an important part of connecting vets to employment, and vice versa is an important way to address issues of income. So,
I can't talk to the nuances of philanthropy, but here's the bottom line. They're a hell of a return on investment. That's what we're seeing, is that if you invest in these folks, they are going to start their own nonprofits. They're going to be teachers. They're going to be community leaders. Their ethos of service continues throughout their life, and they become what we call in the military force multipliers. So, you know, I don't know if they should go to the front of the line, but I think they should be more closely evaluated, because in the original GI Bill in World War II, there was a $7 return to the national economy for every dollar invested. That's, in times that are tough financially, that's a pretty good return. And you can't get that up just about anything in Washington right now. So I think that's the case that we would make. I see so many of our members starting their own nonprofits to tackle the problems from within our community, and they've got the skills, whether it's logistics, technology, command structure, leadership, all these things kind of come into a perfect mix that make them incredible social entrepreneurs. And I'm really excited about the whole crop that are graduating from the schools here in the Bay Area that went to school in the GI Bill and are now coming out. And they're really going to be incredibly impactful leaders, I think, in the next decade.
Yeah, I think there are two things. I'm with Anna, and it's again, I have this sort of schizophrenic reality because I run a service organization as well as I'm in philanthropy. But I do think that there is that I don't think there should be a carve out in philanthropy, as I don't think there should be a carve out in a lot of other sources of funding. That I think we need to leverage the very best of our entrepreneurial spirit and our civic obligations and responsibilities, because they go together. I think often we talk about entrepreneurial spirit and we forget that there's a civic obligation. But I also think that there is a rebranding that needs to happen around charities related to the military. In 2011, the AIP, American Institute for Philanthropy, did a study, and they're the ones that run Charity Watch and Charity Navigator and all those kinds of things. Only one charity that was sort of a military-related charity, okay, not a nonprofit, but a military-related charity, only one did not meet an unsatisfactory grade. So we talk about accountability. We've got to look at the accountability at that level as well, right? Of those, and those are the ones, those are the charities that are related to the official armed forces charities for the U.S. Army and so forth, and it's usually the payroll deduction pieces, okay? Of that, in 2010-11, right, there were $638 million of combined funds in those charities, and only $59 million was dispersed. So I understand that we need more money, but we also have to start, much like the general said, we have to start spending our money a lot smarter and a lot better than what we're doing today.
Well, I have to comment because I'm on a board of a military charity, the Injured Marine Sipper Phi Fund. It's rated A-plus by AIP. It's got 4 stars by the Charity Navigator. It's been that way for 3 or 4 years. It's raised $54 million. It's given out in grants $52 million. And it's to help the families, the Marines that are wounded, to be with their loved ones from the time they arrive at Landstuhl, Germany, because we know they heal faster. They're buying, the VA will pay $27,000 for a van that costs $47,000 for a paraplegic. Our fund pays the difference. So I want to say the Semper Fi Fund meets all that, those criteria, so I don't want anybody leaving here to say all charities are have just given out so much money.
And your fund got the A-plus.
Absolutely.
A-plus certification.
A-plus.
There should be more.
But the thing about should veterans have priority, and my say in this world today, why not? Because they're the only ones that are being asked to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I joined the military when we had the draft, and the American public didn't want the draft. They said they wanted an all-volunteer force. So you want an all-volunteer force to protect your sea lines of communications, to protect you from terrorism and so forth. Why shouldn't somebody that puts their life on the line have an advantage when they come out? Now, I don't believe that's unfair. I think it's unfair if we don't do it. Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to add 2 comments sort of within maybe philanthropic nitty-gritty, but one of the things I look for in looking at organizations to fund is whether they're run by a veteran. I think that's a really important criteria. It's not the only one, but and it's not because it's a carve-out, just because they have the experience. Like, take Swords to Plowshares. Michael Blecker is a veteran. He's been leading this organization for 20-plus years, and I think the insights he has are incredibly important in the leadership of an organization. And then secondly, the philanthropic community has a tendency to micromanage, and I think the more general operating support grants that an organization, a foundation can provide, buy into the leadership and the mission, and then give them the funds they need to do what they're doing. You're trusting their leadership. Tipping Point's been a model of that. So,
another huge challenge that we see, quite frankly, frequently, is that the average civilian thinks we get taken care of at the VA and we get some kind of Willy Wonka gold card and it's all good. That's not the reality. So we do face this challenge that folks think that we just go into the VA and it was like your grandfather's GI Bill and the housing and all this other stuff is there, and it's not the same. And I think the most telling statistic is that only about 51% of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are enrolled in VA healthcare. So we have to come up with creative solutions with philanthropy, with business, with community groups to bridge that gap. Now, the VA will make some headway, I hope, and we're going to do all we can to help them get there. But in the meantime, how do we reach that other 45%? And I think that's the real opportunity to make an impact.
Yeah, and let me just add to that, because we talked about the GI Bill. This post-9/11 GI Bill is wonderful. I mean, it's much better than the Montgomery GI Bill, but it still has some shortfalls, because many of these veterans, they only get the GI Bill when they're actually in school. And, you know, it only pays 36 months or 4 academic years for education. How many kids are getting degrees in 4 years now because classes aren't available and so forth? So it's tough many times. And if philanthropy, if you want to make a difference, I went to a luncheon last week, and I saw what City College here in San Francisco is doing. This is local, right? And they've got, interesting enough, there's 1,200 veterans at City College this year. Mm-hmm. I think there's 700 or 800 at San Francisco State. And one way you can help them in school is that help them with scholarships to bridge those times between semesters when they don't get any of the GI Bill, but they're still trying to pay the rent for their apartment and buy groceries and so forth. And that scholarship program at the community college here in San Francisco is just amazing. So philanthropy could help veterans that way locally.
So I have a number of questions that deal with the number of asking questions about the number of female veterans that we have. For the first time in history, it's a pretty significant percentage of veterans. And so I'm going to read two of those and ask you to respond. One is a statement. As the first female president of the Commonwealth Club and also a retired U.S. Air Force colonel, I found the VA offers little assistance to female veterans. 18% of the force is female, yet little is done to recognize and assist them. So what can be done to assure that female veterans are receiving adequate assistance, particularly re-employment and, I would add, health services?
So let me just jump in, because I think that we're seeing that, which is we're seeing many more women coming to us, women vets coming to us than male men. And what we often hear is a similar kind of story, which is they're not – I can't get the sort of the totality of support and understanding through the traditional means and through the traditional veterans organizations. And so they're coming to us. They're often looking at things like how do we get flexible work schedules? How do we get good, strong family support mechanisms for some of them, for some of the women that are coming to us? How do we find a safe place where we can address some of the issues that we dealt with there, whether it is, the stress, whether it is sexual harassment or a variety of different sources. So, again, this is one slice. And I think one of the things I want to make sure we emphasize is that the veterans community is a diverse community, as is at all communities, okay? But it's important that whether it is whatever organization it is, that we actually provide the kinds of resources and supports and the language and the context which resonates with women and with the kind of service that they have providing for us. I think that's really important. And part of the way we do that is I don't think any single organization can do it. I think the key is collaboration. We have to be able to marry different organizations with different strengths and skills. Right now we have about 75 nonprofit organizations that we partner with because we understand that no one entity can do it all. And so that's, I think, an important aspect of this.
Women's issues are not unique to my generation. And I think that's important to set up as a framework, because most of the existing veteran service organizations do not focus on women, because most of the existing veteran service organizations don't have women members. 15% of our membership is women. We have been a leading voice on the Hill and in communities nationwide to help people understand on a very basic level that women are in combat every single day. They are wounded warriors. They are sacrificing just like their male counterparts. And despite what you might hear, they are on the front lines. They are being wounded and killed, and they're doing everything and then some. But the VA especially was caught completely flat-footed. When I came home in 04, there were VA hospitals without women's bathrooms. I mean, that's a shocking example of how difficult it can be, not to mention the climate within the average VA hospital that we hear about consistently from our staff, from our members. So there needs to be a total command climate overhaul when it comes to addressing the needs of women warriors, and a popular understanding that this is a very different generation, and we've got a long way to go. The VA has had a couple of pilot programs, but there hasn't even been a real national dialogue around the issue at all. And one of the things we've tried to do, again, is to elevate the women warriors who are leaders, like the president of the club. I mean, that's a great story to tell so people can understand. The most common story we hear from our members is that they walk into a VA hospital and they get treated not like a returning hero, but like a candy striper. And that's not okay. So we've got to break that down, and I think we've got a very long way to go, because an overwhelming majority of our members that we recently surveyed were incredibly dissatisfied with the service at the VA especially.
Well, all things we're all prisoners of our past, I guess. But I'll tell you, my recent experiences here with the VA and what's going on with the Veterans Health Research Institute, and I'll go back to this Brain at War conference, but there was a whole presentation there about how they are, in fact, altering how they're dealing with women and how they take care of women veterans. And I found the professional caregivers that the VA had make their presentations are very sensitive to the issues that, yes, we've got to make changes so that we'll be able to make the women comfortable in what used to be an all-men's environment. But I see them working in that direction. So at least from the VA here on the San Francisco Peninsula, both at Fort Miley here in San Francisco and down at Palo Alto, there's a lot of emphasis on let's take good care of the women. Mm-hmm. So I hope maybe it spreads to other VA in the rest of the country. I will tell you, my daughter wrote a play about a woman who actually, she went down to Palo Alto to the women's sexual trauma issue to talk about them, about sexual trauma and the post-traumatic stress dealing with that. And the play is called Welcome Home, Jenny Sutter. If you want to see it, it opened at the Kennedy Center a couple years ago. I was real proud of her. But, I'm just actually kind of proud of what they're doing to alter their processes so that they can take better care of our women veterans. So I'm not hopeless like you, Paul. I think it's...
I'm not hopeless, sir, but hope is not a course of action. And that's what we need more consistently right now.
So we've come to the time in our program where there's only time for one more question. And we have so many. I want to thank the audience members for sending in so many interesting and important questions. But here it is. What happens if we do nothing? What happens if we don't collaborate? What happens if the community doesn't come together? What's the consequence of that? Mike?
Well, this, I think it's a national security issue because the all-volunteer force, and we talked about it before, the all-volunteer force is dependent upon in this millennia generation, these kids that have never ridden in a car without having a seatbelt on, they get permission from their parents to do everything. And by and large, recruiters will tell you that they recruit the parents as much as they do the individual to get the parents' permission for an individual to enlist. That's the future of the all-volunteer force. Do the parents agree that military service for their most precious loved one is going to be good for that individual or not? And if the word ever gets out to the mothers and fathers of these youngsters that by serving in your country, in your country's military, is going to be career-ending, is going to be life-penalizing, do you think that they're going to allow their children to enlist? And my answer is no. So we better do something, or we're going to end up in a, we're going to end up back with the draft and the illiterates in our military, and that's not what you want.
You know, even the premise kind of scares me a bit because we're already deep in demand right now. I mean, suicide rates alone have skyrocketed, and if you're not tracking on the numbers in the active duty army, please do. It's, you know, on average a couple dozen a month, and that's just the active duty army. That doesn't count for the vets who are living here in the Bay Area who aren't on active duty. So that's just one indicator, and I use that because I think it's the most shocking example. It would just be so stupid, and it would be such a waste to miss the opportunity to invest in this generation of folks, not to mention the obvious financial cost of everything from homeless shelters to jail cells. We've been down this road before, and the Vietnam vets deserve tremendous credit for stepping up and teaching this country not to treat us like they were treated. You know, they got caught in the middle, and the way they were received is a national embarrassment. But... you know, the difference now is we're such a small percentage. The chairman of our board is a Vietnam vet, and he said something along the lines of, you know, we were disrespected, you can be ignored. And that's, I think, a bigger danger for our generation because there's so few of us, and it's easy to turn the channel. But I think if we do invest in them, You know, you're going to see a lot of presidents of the Commonwealth Club. You're going to see presidents of the United States. You're going to see incredibly dynamic leaders, just like you have of every generation that came home all the way back to George Washington. So it would be a terrible shame to miss that opportunity.
Anna?
It's hard to say it better than General Myatt in terms of loss to our country and to our sense of civic obligation and how we thrive as an exceptional country. So I won't try to better that. I'll second General Myatt. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think the last thing, we're the first generation that our children, and I have an 8-year-old, our children are going to be less educated and less equipped than their parents. This is the first time in our history as a nation that this is happening. And that's inexcusable. It's just inexcusable. And so, you know, I am an optimist, and I believe that will never happen. We will never turn our backs. We are greater people than that, and we will never turn our backs. And my commitment is, today is the first time I've met many of these people on the podium, and I commit to extending and reaching out to each one of them and seeing how we can take our resources and share it so that we are trying to address this together and not just separately.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much to our panelists today and to our audience. I challenge all of you listening and here with us today to think yourself about what personal commitment you can do to further the cause of the veterans and those who served our country for us so well, both in your personal life, in your personal communities, in your work, in your philanthropy. I hope that you'll leave today thinking about what your own role in that can be. Thank you to Paul Rykoff, Executive Director and Founder of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, Major General Mike Myatt, President and CEO of the Marines Memorial Association, Deborah Alvarez Rodriguez, President and CEO of Goodwill Industries, and Anna Thompson, Executive Director of Charles and Helen Schwab Foundation. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been held in association with United Way of the Bay Area, Northern California Grantmakers, the Association of Fundraising Professionals, the Marines Memorial Association, Tipping Point Community, the Veterans Health Research Institute, Swords to Plowshares, Google, PG&E, and the Grant Humanitarian Foundation. I'm Jane Whitfield, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be in the know, is adjourned.